Nowadays, a wide range of media are available to everyone, from YouTube to blogs, online social networks, and wikis. As a result, the whole notion of access is constantly shifting and changing. Well, have these new gateways made some of the older ones, like public access television, outdated, perhaps even irrelevant? Can the old and new forms of participatory media work together? Well, I'm pleased to welcome Dee Dee Halleck, founder of the New York public access organization Paper Tiger Television, and also Dan Gilmore, director of the Center for Citizen Media and author of a book called We the Media, Grassroots Journalism by the People, for the People, to the show. Hi.
Hi.
Good morning. Or afternoon.
Well, I guess it's still morning in where you are in Phoenix, Arizona.
Right.
But just barely. Let's begin with Dee Dee because we'll talk about public access television first. Is public access television available throughout the country?
It's available in many thousands of cities, and it varies as to how relevant and active it is. In the cities where it's really active, it's amazing, and it's actually one of the most popular channels in those cities.
It's always on cable?
It's on cable, although programs that have been designed for cable, for example, for public access, like the television version of Democracy Now!, is now becoming available on regular public television stations and on other local either educational stations or government stations. So
has that happened on a regular basis? Have people liked what they've seen on a public access station and said, hey, we'll pick it up for CUNY television or for A&E or I can't remember who's doing Democracy Now!, but it's one, like Sundance or one of those, IFC, I think.
Well, Democracy Now! Is Amy Goodman's, and she is one of the most amazing journalists who should be on regular networks. And it is through the grace of the possibility of having the people who love and depend on her promote her on their local channels that she's able to be on in those cities. And it's through Free Speech TV, which is a new network that is part of a public space on the direct broadcast satellites.
Well, how does it work? Who funds public access television? And how did it originate?
Well, the idea is that the cable companies who were coming in, cabling up all these cities, had to go through the telephone poles and the wiring of the municipality. So in exchange for that use of that public right-of-way, they had to give something back. In addition, because they were coming in as a monopoly, they could pick and choose what was on the air. There was a sense that, hey, wait a minute, we need to have some of the channels reserved. So the channels, it depends. Like Tucson, Arizona has like 9 channels of public access. And that includes, like, several of the schools have channels.
The two major universities in that one city.
Yeah, and also the high school has a channel. The arts community has a channel. So it becomes the only local programming because our radios and our TVs now are often very distant. The programming is made very far away from the local communities, and they don't really address the issues that the communities have right at their doorsteps.
My guests are Dee Dee Halleck, media activist and founder of Paper Tiger Television, also Dan Gilmore, director of the Center for Citizen Media and author of the book We the Media. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Dan, you call public access valuable to the local media scene, but say it may be time to phase it out because more modern forms of citizen media have become available. What do you rate as the most successful forms of citizen media today?
I wouldn't rate any single thing particularly more successful than others. And I do want to emphasize that I love public access and love what it has done. What I do think, though, is that in a in an emerging world of essentially unlimited channels, if we want to call it that, perhaps the resources and effort that has gone into the public access system could be as well used in promoting the idea of people creating their own media in many, many different ways for many, many different audiences.
Do you think it's the same kind, the same people create things for public access that are creating people for creating things for the internet, or do you think they're trying to reach the same audiences as well?
Probably not exactly the same, but I think if you go back to the beginning of public access, the media, the activist types in media who wanted to use the tools that were made available, you have some of the same kinds of people doing things like the blogging and more conversational as opposed to lecture form of media that is now emerging. And what seems to me in this case is that we have an opportunity to broaden the participation in a way that has never been possible before. And again, I'm not at all trying to see the end of what these folks do, because it's wonderful, but to expand the vision and the breadth of what they're doing.
Didi, what do you see as the differences between the two? In the end, they all allow people, give people access to broadcasting that they didn't have in the past.
Well, you know, there have been many communities that were real pioneers in providing the kind of internet access. For example, Grand Rapids, Michigan had like 15 years ago had a kind of, initiated a kind of computer access center. What troubles me about the notion that somehow these new media are sort of displace the need for public access is that it's not really all that equitable. Like, there's a lot of use of the internet by the fact that so many people are posting their videos is amazing, but it's really, the question is who has that kind of speed and those access to the tools. And what public access has done in so many communities is provide a base for people to learn to use those tools and also to bring people together. I mean, so much of this Facebook, it's to call it a social networks is such a contradiction, because it doesn't really build up our social communities. And what public access has done has do that, bringing people in to work together and to watch each other's, learn about each other's cultures and make work with each other, to work together.
Dan, so let's talk about some of those things. Doesn't web video, for example, require a lot more technical sophistication than simply filming a church service and sending it out to be aired by the local cable company?
Well, it depends what you want to do with it. The tools of creating media are now much more, let's call it, democratized than they have been.
I mean, it's easy. It would be easy for me to put together a film and put it on YouTube, because the thought of it is just too daunting.
I think the word easy is probably the wrong one in this case, but it's not difficult the way it used to be. You don't need a studio or a fancy camera to do something of reasonably high quality. And the other thing that's important to remember is that people growing up now, and this is not distributed universally. This is still more in the hands of the middle class and upper class, but is spreading out. People growing up are essentially what are being called digital natives, and a lot of this comes as second nature to someone who's growing up today. I think we're seeing a fluency with digital media among younger people that certainly makes me gawk in surprise, and also I learn a lot from them.
But what about the argument that public access television really is available to poor people, whereas you do have to have computer equipment, you have to have some other fancy equipment here. What we're talking about, most of these other things, most of the other citizen media, require a certain amount of investment, real dollars.
A certain amount, yes, but the amount is dropping at a rapid rate. And I am not trying to be some sort of techno-determinist or Pollyannish here, but the cost of this gear and the software and the access is dropping at a dramatic rate, and the ease of use is increasing at a dramatic rate. Over time, that puts the tools in pretty much everyone's hands. And again, it's over time, not instantly.
My guests are Dan Gilmore, director of the Center for Citizen Media, author of the book We the Media, Grassroots Journalism by the People, for the People, and Dee Dee Halleck, who is founder of Paper Tiger Television. And we are talking about various forms of citizen media. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. We're talking about various forms of citizen media with Dee Dee Halleck, who is founder of Paper Tiger Television, and Dan Gilmore, who's director of the Center for Citizen Media and author of the book We the Media. One of the things, one of the big controversies over public access was censorship and control of content. Is that something that distinguishes it from the things that we can put on the Internet, Dee Dee?
Well, actually, you can put pretty much anything on the Internet.
In Brooklyn, all we get on BCAT usually is church services and films of people who are dancing.
Well, I think part of that is the kind of outreach that BCAT has done in the past, which has been fairly limited. You see a very different kind of programming here in Manhattan, where many ethnic groups have used the media, and many wonderful creative young people are doing regular shows. And I think it's starting to happen at BCAT. I know there's a Paper Tiger guy there now who's doing wonderful educational work. I think
so. What, it wasn't policy, it was simply the way the thing developed?
Well, I think it that's the thing about public access. It varies from city to city. And in Brooklyn, it was very much controlled by the Brooklyn political organization, which was interested in basically promoting the borough president and nothing else. But in terms of censorship or thinking about the kind of content that's on in the Internet, one of the things that worries me about those so-called social networks is the fact that it gobbles up all this wonderful energy, goodwill, and creativity that people have. When you sign up and post a picture or video, very few people read the fine print. It's like you're giving up your right to your own material. All the rights belong to Google or some other big mega corporation, who, in addition to posting ads on the free content you're providing them, in addition to the data mining, which they do, to get a complete readout of all your preferences, everything from food to movies, they also archive your creativity. Who knows what's going to happen with all those little videos that people have posted? I think we have not begun to realize that, and I think that they own that in perpetuity. So what's going to happen with that material?
Dan?
That's a very, very good issue, and one that concerns me a lot, the ownership question. Certainly YouTube takes and Google, which owns it, take a very proprietary stand on what you submit to them. But they're not the only thing out there. There's for example, a site called BlipTV, blip.tv, which has, as part of its licensing, a Creative Commons option, which Creative Commons is a copyright license that basically instead of all rights reserved, says some rights reserved, and means that you can share it, you can keep it, you still own it. It quite specifically says we only get to use it ourselves too, but it's yours, the creator. So there are plenty of options for people who worry about this, and we need to make them much more well-known in the community of people creating. I do also want to address the question of people, the idea that this is putting people off in their own corners and that they're not getting together. There are many things happening relating to some of these social networks and sites like meetup.com, which is based there in New York, which uses the online tools to get people together in the real world, in the analog physical world. So we have plenty of reason to think that over time these tools will be used collaboratively and not just remotely.
Go ahead. No, finish what you were going to say. I'm sorry.
So I'm concerned about the idea of people isolating themselves, but I don't think it's necessarily the end point in this at all.
Well, and many public access shows are done by a large group. They are the equivalent of doing a regular television show, and people learn how to use the equipment. They learn how to produce. They learn how to perform. There's a lot more of a sense of community, isn't there?
Well, I would imagine that when you get a large group in a room together, you will develop more community at the level that they're doing it. But people online also create communities, and they also get together offline in the real world. It's not this absolute separation.
Can we talk a bit about who regulates the internet? Hasn't that been a big issue? Well, first of all, who regulates public access television? Don't the cable systems, DD, require that they pass on things before they put them on the air?
There are some that do, but actually, it's up to the local city to set up a franchise that includes provisions such as that there can't be any interference from the cable company. But what's happening in terms of the whole national picture is that that as Verizon and AT&T are coming in and providing television, are wanting to, they are trying to change the laws because they don't want to be subject to the same requirements that cable companies are. So they have actually gone into on a statewide level and lobbied very, very heavily. Actually, apparently it's the heaviest lobbying that AT&T has ever done to actually make state laws that actually undercut the local regulations that require public access.
So they would like to eliminate public access from
any
systems
much.
That they run?
Yes, very. Well, they are not right now not required. What we at the Alliance for Community Media are suggesting is that there should be public access across platforms. So whether or not Verizon is providing you TV, that they also need to provide channels for local action and programs, and also local provide some kind of support for it, because that's the other thing that happens is that many cities have a percentage of the profits that come in from cable actually go to support the public access. But one of the things that interesting things, if the government should change and we get a Democratic FCC, and there are members of the COPS and Edelstein at the FCC have a great respect and fondness for public access. And actually, one of the things, we had a meeting at a media reform conference recently in Minneapolis, and one of the things they actually asked a group of public access leaders from around the country is, what kind of national law would you want that would actually protect public access and actually then override some of the state laws that have been constructed, which are providing havoc in many public access centers around the country.
Dan, are you at all concerned that John McCain has admitted to computer illiteracy. He's just learned how to, as he says, do the Google.
I'm not too happy to hear about that because, although I, you know, look, the president has staff to do lots and lots of stuff, but in a world of media and digital saturation, to not know the basics of using some of this technology, I think, is problematic at best. But if I could also address what Didi just said, I actually go the opposite direction on this. I would let the phone companies that are providing TV do whatever they want, and I would let actually the cable people, I'd give them a 10-year sunset where they train a million people to use these tools to create great digital media that could or could be on television, could be on the internet, could be anywhere. And that the big concern I have in this category is the developing duopoly in internet access that the cable and phone companies in a given community enjoy. And they are demanding and getting, which is scary, the right not just to deliver the bits, but to decide what order they get delivered at what speed, if they get delivered at all. That is really scary, and we need to do something about that.
That's the so-called net neutrality, which actually people are hoping there is going to be some way to ensure that anything you get on the internet will come at the same speed as anything else, and I think that's very, very important.
But Didi, I want to go back to the changing of the rules, if the rules are changed. The Cable Franchise Act, which was enacted in 1984, required cable companies to fund local municipalities so that they were able to provide training and access to media technology. This was seen also as a way to give people who might not, in other circumstances, the tools to create media. If we have a two-tier system, well, won't one pretty much kill off the other?
Well, we certainly
have... Or is this no longer a problem for us?
You mean two tiers in terms of cable versus Verizon, et cetera?
Yes.
Actually, I get my internet now through the cable company, so I'm not so sure that you can actually separate all these things, or you certainly can't now, nor will you more increasingly so in the future. So, but I think that all of these tools utilize public infrastructure, and you know there's a it's the commons. It's something we should share. And it shouldn't. And if they are using that to make a profit, there should be a give back to the communities. Of course, Verizon and AT&T, if they're putting up these things, they look like refrigerators in your yard. I mean, actually, if you Google refrigerator and AT&T, somebody put up some kind of photoshopped images of what it looks like when AT&T comes to your community. And because there's some kind of federal regulation that says a local community can't, like, suppress information, they can't, the local planning board can't even ask for them to go down. So you're going to see these, like, monstrosities in communities all over the place. You already see them.
Dan, you published your book, We the Media, under the Creative Commons license. What are the benefits of that agreement for you as an author?
The main benefits, well, there are a number. One is that while I believe very much in the copyright system, I think it's grossly abused by the entertainment industry. And that it was meant to be a balance between authors' incentives and public knowledge, and has become grossly unbalanced. But the advantage for the author, at least in my case, was that the work I was doing got spread more widely. When that book was published, Maybe it was a little early. I don't know what happened. But in this country, newspapers completely ignored it. It got like one review, and that was the one I worked for at the time. And had I not done it that way, it would not have gotten out there in the way that it did. It's a license that said we basically, if anyone is going to make money on the book, we'd rather it be us. That means me and the publisher. But otherwise, feel free, just send it around. There's no indication that it hurt sales at all, and in fact probably helped, because, again, the ability to spread the word more widely and to have people understand that, yes, we believe in copyright, but we also believe in knowledge at some larger level.
Didi, who owns the rights to the programs that are broadcast on public access television?
Well, there are some franchises that have put in clauses that say anything that's actually produced using equipment or studios there belongs to the local public access place. But most of them don't. I mean, I'd say it's a minority of stations of the centers that actually do that. But mostly it's the people who actually make the programs are allowed to have rights, complete rights to that. And if they want to distribute it on YouTube, go ahead. If they want to put it on Blip, they can do that, and many do. And in fact, I mean, there's many of the public access stations are now streaming all of their programming.
Now, both of you are academics. Didi, you're professor emerita in the Department of Communication at the University of California, San Diego. What are your students telling you? Are they telling you they're interested in public access, or would they prefer now to take advantage of the various things that are available on the internet?
Well, it's interesting. Last spring, I taught at Vassar for a quarter, and the class had its own blog, and it was a wonderful experience. I must say, I recommend it to any teachers listening. It was a wonderful, not an individual blog. That's what was so interesting, is that it was a class blog, and one of the requirements were that the students had to comment on each other's work, and it was really beautiful.
Dan Gilmore, you're director of a new Knight Center for Digital Media Entrepreneurship at Arizona State University's Walter Cronkite School of Journalism and Mass Communication, also the director of the Center for Citizen Media. What are your students telling you? Are you able to keep up with them?
I do my best. I've been in sort of remedial training, actually, in the last week on the latest Photoshop and things like that. But they're so interesting because they're somewhat native to this technology and to these media. What they're not particularly well-versed in is how this becomes something we would recognize as journalism or valuable community information, trustworthy. And that's part of the process, but I certainly learn from them, I hope, at least as much in some ways as they learn from me.
So you teach content, and they know the latest technological advances.
Well, I'm pretty good on the technology. I've spent a lot of years in Silicon Valley, but what we're trying to do is basically convince students that not only can they invent their own jobs in the future, but they may have to.
I want to thank you both so much for being with us. Dan Gilmore is director of the Center for Citizen Media, also the Knight Center for Digital Media Entrepreneurship at Arizona State University's Walter Cronkite School of Journalism and Mass Communication. Didi Halleck is the founder of Paper Tiger Television, co-founder of Deep Dish Satellite Network. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.